That said, we'll take our first scenario. And the scenario is that you, sitting in the audience or up here in the panel, are a senior leader at your hospital. And you receive continuous complaints from residents or from surgeons and OR nurses about a young surgeon's abusive and disruptive behavior in the OR and also on the wards. We're going to ask our panel, Dr. Healy is going to run the discussion, ask our panel, how do you resolve these issues?
So thank you, Dr. Hanks. We really encourage you all to get involved in this discussion, because I think the purpose of this panel is to help folks out there deal with issues that are not uncommon in many places in this country. This particular scenario would indicate that it's probably an academic medical center, but it could be a community center that has rotating residents coming from an academic center, or it actually could be a community hospital which doesn't have residents, but has a senior surgeon whose responsibility is to run things appropriately, and he or she is asked to deal with a problem by the operating room nursing staff. So picture this scenario in your own mind as we formulate some answers and how people might handle this situation. But I would suspect that everyone in this audience either knows about some case that's similar to this or has actually experienced something like this and has been on the, as they say, hook to deal with it. So let's start out and take this case and get the panel to give us some input about how they might handle it. So Dr. Rozicki, at a place like Hopkins where you work, which is a large academic medical center, how do you think this might be dealt with in your institution by, say, the surgeon in chief or, you know, a senior leader in the Department of Surgery, residency director or someone like that?
Well, a couple of things that strike me here that says it's got to go up the chain is that it's their continued complaints. This is not just one blow up. It's not like something went wrong. Oh, this is out of characteristic. And that also the complaints are coming from residents and OR nurses. So that tells you that you have diverse input here. They're continuous and there's a pattern. So this is an abusive disruptive behavior that is not just a spark or a off-the-cuff complaint. So this goes to a senior leader. A senior leader could be residency program director. In the case of the residents, I suspect that's who would be handling it, maybe the chair, but most likely the resident program director could be the CNO or nursing clinical manager or whatever. And then also sometimes the CMO. I think the one thing that Johns Hopkins does very well is put forth a very clear and transparent code of conduct. What are the expectations? So that everybody knows that if a situation occurs like this, you are held responsible. Here is the information. It is crystal clear, and it is across the board. There are no exceptions. So I think that's the step number one, that would be addressed.
Okay. So let's switch it a little bit, Dr. Corrado, because let's say this guy is a young hotshot that's been recruited to your community hospital. And he's been recruited because the CEO of the hospital thinks we need more cases and we need this guy's expertise in endoscopic surgery, et cetera, et cetera. So now he's bringing in a lot of money, okay? But the OR nurses come to you, Dr. Corrado, is say you're the chief of surgery at this hospital, and what are you going to talk to this guy about? What are you going to say to him? How are you going to handle it?
Well, I think in a small place this happens, just as it does in the tertiary care centers. And I think, first of all, I would, as the chief of the department, I would sit down with the operating room nurses, and if there were residents involved, sit down with them and make sure that I got all the ducks in order and got a good story. You know, we see more and more problems with disruptive physicians And so in a small place, this would probably get up to the medical executive committee. The administrator would probably start talking to me. And I would actually then confront that person. And in a collegial way, I would sit down and say, listen, this is what has gone on. And this is what we're hearing. Let's hear your side of the story. And if there's an obvious problem, then we sit down and in the old days, we used to put them in a box, so to speak, give them parameters and say, okay, this committee has met and we feel that you are being abusive, you are being disruptive, and we have to set some rules. And if you continue in this avenue of behavior, then there's going to be consequences.
Dr. Schechter, most hospitals now have programs to deal with physician issues of stress, and we heard a lot now about the term burnout. This is a young surgeon. It turns out that data is beginning to show us that young surgeons are not immune from this, even though they're early in their careers. What kind of programs would your hospital offer, and how would you advise this person to deal with his, whether it's aggressive behavior, anger management, or whatever you might want to call it? Is that something that's going on in your hospital, or is it something you think is important?
The answer is yes, but I'd just like to preface my remarks by saying that this is an example of workplace violence. And workplace violence can be physical violence, or it can be verbal abuse, but everybody has to feel safe in their environment. So I think that's a prerequisite. Second, this is repetitive behavior, and if I was the leader in the department, and I was for 16 years, I would view this as a technical error on my part, in the sense that I allowed this behavior to become repetitive and then become a problem outside of the department. Because, you know, if you take a Kabbalistic view of what a leader is, there has to be kindness and support for a young person who's at the beginning of his career, who is obviously getting into deep trouble and is about to get sucked down the spiral. So we want to support that person. On the other hand, you have to make sure everybody feels safe and the rules or the regulations take place. So there's a fine balance between being a mentor, supporter of a young patient, an advocate, and making sure that everything gets taken care of in a way where that's appropriate and follows the rules and regulations. So it's a balance. So I would hopefully, and I've not always been successful but I would hopefully been able to deal with this problem by having a crucial conversation with the person before it got outside of the department. Once it gets outside of the department, now you've got a much more complex problem, because you've got multiple
right.
bodies within the hospital taking care of it, and that's likely to have an adverse effect on the person's career. So I think if you can intervene earlier, that's appropriate. And yet, and to answer your specific question, yes, at University of California, San Francisco, we have a specific body that deals with stress, insecurity, and problems with professionalism. And we have on various occasions referred, made mandatory referrals of people who were misbehaving in one way or another to this group, and they go. There's actually an entire program they go through with mandatory visits to a psychologist, etc.
Right.
Sometimes it's successful.
Sometimes
and sometimes it's not.
Dr. Hanks, you wanted to make a comment.
I think Dr. Schechter got after it a little bit, but I just wanted to hear a little bit more from the other panelists. You talked about the balance, the carrot and the stick. When you're talking with a young person who, even though this is a continued circumstance, may not be totally aware of the magnitude of the issue that he or she is bringing. So what positive things can you offer in terms of you should go this way versus the stick saying, gee, if you don't, this can happen? Because in my time as president of clinical staff, everybody was saying, well, we're just going to get rid of our clinical privileges or something. And that's just, that seems to me like hitting a fly with a sledgehammer when you can take care of it in a different way. But what sorts of carrots and sticks do we have available?
So Jacob, maybe you can answer that because, or Dr. Mullen, the person in question here, in some sense, is becoming a patient himself, okay? So as physicians, we have a little obligation to him. This isn't totally one-sided. It isn't just, you know, we got to support the nurses, which we do. But we also have to look at him as a possible patient. Why is he angry and so forth? So can you give us a little of what Dr. Hanks is saying? Let's go with the carrot a little bit first and help and address that.
I appreciate the privilege of trying to relate to this serial abuser at work, but that aside, I do think that most commonly when there is a situation like this, there has to be an underlying cause. And I think that as the person who is tasked with bringing this to a resolution that is mutually satisfactory, the key is figuring out what that cause is and seeing if that could be remedied. Often under conditions of stress like this that manifest with violence, there's a lack of awareness. And I think that illuminating the consequences of the abusive behavior is probably the first step. But as Dr. Schechter pointed out, if this is already beyond the department and human resources is involved, the chair or the program director's hands may be tied in terms of how many carrots they are able to offer. And so I think it becomes a much more difficult situation.
Well, as a moderator for this, I'd like to offer a couple of comments because I personally had to deal with this myself. And the way I tried to handle it with this young person was asking them to sit down and talk about it, reminding them that we in the department were a family and that families have rules. And if you want to be a responsible member of the family, you live by the rules. And that family members are held to some level of accountability. But family members sometimes get ill and have stress, and part of the family's duty is to help them. And there are plenty of resources available in this country to help people, as Dr. Schechter pointed out, in his hospital and so forth. But the other piece of this that we have to remember is you as the head of surgery or the chief surgeon in whatever hospital, whatever role, it will reflect on you if you don't deal with this. Because those nurses, if you don't deal with this person in some way that's visible and effective, you become just as guilty of the problem as the perpetrator. So I think it's important to remember that you have an obligation as essentially the head of the family to deal with this. Now, we really like you guys to come up to the microphones and either disagree with us, share your own experience, or offer some other ideas about how you might deal with this. So I see, Dr. Hanks, you want to run that part of it, and we have someone at the microphone there, I see.
Yes, I'm Rekha Singh. I'm from New Britain, Connecticut. And I have a question about how we have evolved as a profession. The scenario you painted was that of a junior surgeon. In my experience, it's been more of senior surgeons who have really gotten away with certain behaviors for years, sometimes decades. Sometimes, you know, it's sort of normalized deviance. Their behavior has been accepted for a long period of time. Until finally, you know, as we have evolved, we kind of step up and say, this is not acceptable anymore. And I think that has been a challenge to many of us as to how do we deal with our response when we're just not going to take that kind of behavior anymore.
really, really important point. I reflect back on my early years, and I remember a chief surgeon who was like this, and he was referred to as Dr. Zeus because he saw himself as Zeus. So I think, panel, this is a very good question to ask. Dr. Rozicki, how would you address the fact that maybe this is a very senior surgeon, or it could be the surgeon in chief, him or herself?
Yeah, I think
more likely a himself.
It does bring up a good point. And I think one of the key aspects has been, over the past several years, we have reached a tipping point in our healthcare culture. And I believe even the leadership, the administrators, the CEOs have recognized that less of this disruption is actually better for the patient, better for the economics of the healthcare system itself. And I think that is coming more to the forefront. So it doesn't matter what that surgeon brings to the table and the expertise relative to a lot of money for the hospital. Mm. This culture of well-being, I think, is seen as very valued. So I think that's been a tipping point. And then I think the other part is that we are speaking up more. And medical students and residents are now, I know we go through training scenarios and role model playing, multidisciplinary, with the anesthesiologists, the orthopedic surgeons, and so forth, who actually show what happens or what can happen in a disruptive situation. So we're beginning that education process, and I think that is helping.
Dr. Schechter, is this a safety problem, patient safety problem, with people acting like this, especially senior surgeons?
I think it could be. If you take the, and we've talked about this many times in the past in, on safety issues, on an aircraft carrier, the most junior person on the flight deck can abort the launch of an aircraft if he or she sees something wrong. On the other hand, if you're working in the operating room or even in the ICU or in the ward, and you've got a person who behaves in this manner, creates fear on the staff, they're afraid to speak up and get their head bit off, and I think this could very easily adversely affect patient safety.
Other comments, Dr. Hanks?
We have another question from the audience.
Okay.
Well, I don't have a question. I know this person. I brought this person generically into my hospital, and I thought I'd kind of hit the jackpot. He seemed wonderful. I got great recommendations from his training program. But it turned out he did all of the above here. And in the end, it turned out he was bipolar and could not be stopped from doing what he was doing. But, you know, I think every hospital has a peer review committee, and I think that's where certainly it can start. Any complaints about anybody's behavior can be dealt with anonymously or reported anonymously to a peer review committee, and it can go from there. In this case, with this young guy, I started basically with a father-son talk many times. Nothing worked. He's now out of surgery. He had his privileges were taken away, and he's in law school now. But there are some things, frankly, that can't be
just
fixed.
Just what we needed.
Someone
comments? Joe?
Someone made a point. It's very important. You know, our culture has changed dramatically. And now even small hospitals, they've been taken over by systems. It used to be easier in the sense that it was almost you could take care of it as a family. But it's more important now. Anyone can anonymously, with a click of a computer, okay, have a complaint. Once that goes up the system, like you said, it's out of the hands for the most part of the hospital. It's very, very difficult. Then you get legal lawyers involved, and then you have the Board of Healing Arts of the state involved, and it can be serious consequences. So we take this stuff seriously.
Yes. Dr. Markham, did you want to?
Sure.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to take that first.
Next one. Yes, sir.
Hi, Bob Sawin from Seattle. I wanted to put a plug in for coaches. I know last year this committee sponsored a panel about mentorship and coaching, and there was some discussion about the differences, and I think there are some. And I'm at an institution where people like this are offered the opportunity for working with what has typically been called an executive coach, but there's a subgroup of these executive coaches now that are that are finding a niche in medicine, helping physicians who are struggling in ways like this. And sometimes, I mean, in my own institution, I've seen, I'd say more often than not, successful turnaround of just this kind of surgeon with the help of an executive coach who becomes his or her advocate, helps them understand why they do the things they do, what the triggers might be. So I just make a plea for coaching in such situations as part of that carrot.
I think that's an important point because for all we know, this young person had a bad role model and saw someone who was effective in using this type of behavior to get what they wanted and therefore recreates what he or she learned. So anyway, I'm sorry I avoided you guys over there. It's hard to see. That's why we need you all on this side.
Don't
but anyway,
be shy.
Is there someone over there?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So as somebody involved in peer review at my hospital, let's change the scenario a little bit. Young female surgeon who, when she's reached out to, says, I'm being hazed by the nursing staff and being written up for behaviors that are completely routine for other surgeons in the operating room. I don't know if I can keep working here. What do you do with that? And then a question to respond to a comment that was made earlier. There is a sense that you have to show the complainant or the aggrieved parties that something's been done. How do you balance that with really the confidentiality of the peer review process or any counseling that goes on?
Dr. Mollem, how about you handle that one?
I think that especially with confidentiality clauses that get involved, once there is a formal HR complaint, that balance is extremely difficult. And we've seen this actually in our own department very recently where there was a complaint. And the piece of it that was actually the most difficult to manage was the rumor mill that also starts spiraling around a situation like this, where a complaint like this often has far more than two sides. And each side feels like they deserve an explanation and deserve to see activity very, very quickly. But controlling the message is something that, under the confines of confidentiality laws, is nearly impossible. And so I think that it takes a lot of skill to be able to assure the complainant and other people who are involved in the case that it is being handled, but there has to be preset trust that when you are able to disclose what is happening, you will. But people just have to understand that there are legal restrictions on full disclosure.
So I'd like to expand that question because I've had to deal with this in my experience with two young women in my own department who were being, I don't want to use the term hazed by the nurses, but we're being stressed by nurses in the OR. Dr. Rozicki, is this an issue that some young women surgeons have to deal with, and have you seen this, and how do you think, have they come to you for advice, and how would you handle it?
I think it is an issue, and you brought up a very good aspect of that is female and then the nurses, because most of the nurses would be women also. Not all of them, but most. And I think that there's a central point here. One is remarks and trying to address competency issue. Are the remarks relative to competency? Because if you dissect down, sometimes that is not the case. And I think that at least helps you to go off on the other foot. Is it more or less a personality issue or some other factors that enter into this? I think that when competency is adequate or excelled, that's a good footing for at least making a break on some of these, because you can at least then move from there in the decision matrix to sort this out a little better. So to me, I anchor it on competency.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Jeff Smith. I'm a surgeon from San Diego, and I don't want to detract from the other important issue, but the sequence was that he knew that surgeon. I just wanted to add the perspective. I know that surgeon too, and that surgeon's me. And so I think that's just part of the discussion that wasn't at one of the sessions last year, and I think it's important to see the other side. And my perspective is that the system created that surgeon.
So tell us about it.
So I think that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of hazing in our process. The role models are not particularly good. And then when people don't recognize burnout and assist people with it, then you're on your own to deal with it with whatever way you have. And to whatever level that goes, you're going to go to whatever level of decompensation it arises. Fortunately, my situation was that it exploded into a massive event, and then they decided to take action. And since there were really no other issues other than burnout, I got through that process quite well. I'm also a smart individual, and when given the opportunity to improve, I'll improve. But I've now turned it around. And again, just one of the speakers pointed about it, I've now gotten into surgeon coaching. And so that's one of the things that I do to provide the service back to others in multiple issues, not just ones that are ones that I've experienced. And I would just sort of two key messages that I think are important. One is to demonstrate compassion, like you alluded to, that see the surgeon as a patient and try to direct as much compassion towards that individual as possible. And I think that surgeons in that situation, again, I'm not even really, my situation is so far in the past, it's really not much of an issue, but I can reflect and think about it. But that when you give, if you intervene early, if you give people choices, then they don't necessarily feel cornered, and it probably will improve the response.
Well, we applaud you for bringing this to our attention and sharing your own personal experience, because that's immensely valuable. I suspect for some people in the audience, it certainly is for me listening to you. And I think that it really brings up some very important points, that a lot of good people can be salvaged if people reach out to them and see them as in the role of a patient rather than a trainee or, you know, a staff member, et cetera. So thank you, sir. Yes, Bill.
I greatly appreciate your comments, and it just raised a thought with me, and that is, Not only do the people who are on the receiving end of the experience deserve to feel safe, but the person who is committing these actions in terms of making a corrective action, that person needs to feel safe too. And unfortunately, when the process happens outside of the family, that is outside of the department, it is necessarily following a series of rules and regulations where you're going through multiple committees, and this person who is trying, you know, who most of the time, not always, but most of the time is trying to improve and sort themselves out, is getting feeling increasingly unsafe, and that's a problem. And that's why I think we, as much as possible, we ought to try to deal with it within the department, if at all, as much as possible.
Okay, we're going to move on, but just to close this out, the one last thing I'd like to say is that we all have bad days. There isn't a surgeon in this room that hadn't gotten up one morning and had a bad day. And maybe have acted, I know I have, in a way you're not proud of. But the important thing is, if you reflect on it yourself, you make your own diagnosis, and you deal with it immediately, and you go to the nurses and say, you know, I'm really sorry. That's not who I am. And I didn't mean to yell at you. I didn't mean to use profanity. It's not who I am, and I'm just having a bad day. Most people are forgiving human beings, and most of your nursing staff or your colleagues will say, okay, let's move on, and that's fine. But I think the idea of this repetitive behavior is the problem we're talking about, not the fact that all of us have a bad day and regret some of the things we might have said or done in a particular 24-hour period. So I just want to make that, you know, comment that everybody doesn't have to be a choir boy in the world. We're not. And so the reality is a reflection, and the world is full of forgiveness, and you just need to reach out for it sometimes.